Thank you. Here we go. Great. Good afternoon. Welcome to our panel discussion today on wetlands, wells, and wick drains. Thank you all for showing up and sharing your afternoon with us. My name is Kate Black. I live here in Willits, and I've been asked to welcome you today and introduce the panel and moderator. First off, we'd like to thank our local Grange for hosting this event. And we'll ask Annie Weller to come up and tell us a little about the Grange.
Hi, everyone. Wow, I'm loud. Thank you for coming today. It's great to see the room full. And I wanted to tell you we've spent about $250,000 on the Grange in the last couple of years, and we're really happy to have this beautiful community center and to offer it free for events like this. We would also like to just ask if, as part of the community, you just put a dollar or two in this. We need to paint the front of the building. So please help us put new windows in to keep the moisture. We're going to talk about moisture today, but we don't want it in the building. So just help us a little bit out. I know you want to donate to Solve today. Please be generous to Solve and just give a little bit to the Grange, and we'll keep fixing this place up and offering it out to the community. Thank you.
And we also want to thank Solve, S-O-L-L-V, Save Our Little Lake Valley, for sponsoring this event today. And I just want to personally thank, and all of us, Cindy Morninglight, who really pulled things together, and the whole team. There were many people involved in making this event happen. Before I introduce the panel here, let's just go through a few logistical things. Out the back, to the left, and at the end of the hall are the restrooms. We have refreshments for you back there, some very yummy cookies and other things by donation, please. And there's an information table for Solve, and also there are T-shirts on sale if you'd like to pick up one of those. We also want to thank Jessica for these wonderful displays back there, and please take a look before you leave. This event is meant to focus on educating us on our wetlands and water. And obviously, it will have something to do with the bypass plan, but the focus today is on our watershed issues. In a moment, I'll introduce the panel and moderator, but I just want you all to know that after each panelist has approximately 15 minutes to present, then we'll have a very short 5-minute stretch break, and let's really try to keep it to 5 minutes, prior to the Q&A, question and answer, session. Before you get up to stretch, please be sure and let us have time to pass around the basket so that we can pick up your questions that you have written for the panel, so that we can do that during the second part. And also during open discussion after the Q&A, we will ask you to limit your comments to 1 to 3 minutes, and we'll have a timer to help us out with that. And now let's ask Donna Kerr to come up and make a few announcements here before we get started.
Thank you again for coming out on a beautiful Sunday. A couple of real quick announcements from Solve, Save Our Little Lake Valley. For people who are not aware or have never been to a meeting, I wanted to let you know that we do meet regularly in a large body at the library. Ooh, I wonder why. At the library, Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. And that is a good place to find what group you might want to participate in, to get active and find out, get further educated, find out more information. So Friday nights at the library, 5 o'clock. Also, we do have a website. Back on the information table, there is a brochure. The website is on the back. That's the best way to get all the information at one shot. We are going to talk about contacting legislators, and there is also, amongst the other information on the table, there is a lovely little handout sheet that gives you email contacts, telephone contacts, if you feel like you need to contact a legislator, and you do. Also, Thank you to John Ford, just came in and brought us the latest news release from the Farm Bureau, and copies of that are also back on that table. There are a couple of important dates coming up. I'm going to mention one trip that is important, and then I'm going to ask Patricia Kovner to mention another. The end of this week, May 2nd and 3rd, Thursday and Friday, there is a caravan, we hope, going to Sacramento. And the purpose of this trip is to meet with our legislators. We put them there. They should be responsive to us. We are in the process of getting actual appointments with them. But we need large numbers of people to show up, because Willits is just a dot on their radar. If you want them to listen to you, you need to be there. So we are going to ask people to see if you can become part of this caravan. There will be contact information at the back on who is going. We need riders. We need bodies to show up. We need drivers. We'll carpool as best as possible. But this is important, because these are the people. We can go to Jerry Brown's office and ask him to please pick up the phone and tell us whether he is running the state of California or whether Caltrans is. So this is important. There are other trips happening, and I'm going to turn that information over. I think Patricia is here to tell you about another important upcoming trip. Thank you.
Hi. For those of us who are committed to this, ending this bypass project, the end of the line is really the California Transportation Commission, CTC, which will meet in Los Angeles May 7th. This is like running the race, but not crossing the finish line, as our friend Jamie said. These are the people that have snatched the funds twice before from this project and will make a final decision on whether we need this $300 million four-lane freeway or somebody else needs it in California better. So we have a bus going, leaving here on May 6th at night. We're going to drive down at night. Now, this is a Green Tortoise bus. For any of you, the alternative to the Greyhound, get it? It's outfitted specially so that we can put down the tables and chairs and sleep on the bus like sardines in our sleeping bags at night while they drive. We'll wake up in L.A. the morning of the 7th. We'll have all day there to lobby, whatever. We can strategize on the bus. And then we'll come home that night. Now, it's right by Union Station. If you have to be in L.A., we have the most beautiful train station in the world, Alvera Street and the Mexican markets, Japantown, and, of course, being inside the commission lobbying. So we need your body or your money or both to help send people down there. And if you can't go, maybe you can support someone who can. I'm going to pass this around. And if you can get on that bus, we need 34 people. If you flew down, you'd be spending twice as much for hotel, meals, whatever. It's $175, and they carry the food on there. You've got your hotel, your community, your meals, and your transportation all in one. So if you have to go to L.A., this is a good way to go.
Another local event that also is going to have to do with our bypass issues is on May 13th. It's Monday at 6:30. It's sponsored by the Willits Community Alliance, which has been having a whole series of meetings every once a month. And this particular one will be featuring Ellen Drell talking about the background on the bypass and also some of the justification and lack thereof for this freeway as solving our little bottleneck here. So that's Monday, May 13th at 6:30 at the library.
Thank you, Madge Strong. Just want to let you know that Sheriff Allman can be with us till approximately 3:30 p.m. today. So at the end of our formal discussion, we're slated to do this from 1 to 4. Please feel free for an informal discussion. Just stay and talk with your neighbors. I'm going to introduce the panel here. Let me just get my notes in order. Our moderator today, as you know, is there anyone who does not know this remarkable man who serves our community in so many different ways? He really needs no introduction, and we thank him for his presence here today and all that you do. Sheriff Tom Allman. David Parch, at the very far end of the table, is a singer, songwriter, guitar player, choir member, poet, philosopher, permaculture consultant and instructor, watershed advocate, horticulturist, compost builder, land sculptor, carpenter, computer scientist, recording engineer, artistic clothes model, amateur husband, and all-around troublemaker. In short, he is a jack of all trades and master of very little. I would like to introduce Rosamond Crowder. She is an artist. She recently painted the mural, the fantastic mural, opposite the post office depicting the Eel River watershed. She's the daughter of a geologist and a city planner, later director of an open space district. Rosamond grew up with a scientific view of the landscape, but also an understanding of the human interface. Living in Willits for 20 years, she is on the board of the Willits Environmental Center and also the Willits Outlet Creek Watershed Group. Thank you. And sitting next to Sheriff Allman is Bob Whitney, president of Golden State Land Conservancy. Currently, Bob prepares conservation easements, manages mitigation lands, facilitates watershed restoration, conducts monitoring, economic analysis, and assesses environmental compliance for wildlife, trails, forest, farm, and ranch conservation throughout California. He also co-founded the Environmental Defense Center, a regional public interest environmental law firm based in Santa Barbara. Bob is the secretary of the Seabiscuit Heritage Foundation, based on the Ridgewood Ranch, the home of Seabiscuit. He has successfully worked for over 45 years in private enterprise and taught computer science, mathematics, business, economics, and accounting at both the secondary and the college levels. So I hand it over to you, Sheriff Allman.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much to the organizers. This is a very organized event, and I appreciate being allowed to moderate. For the last 3 days, I've had people in town ask me, why do you want to mediate the bypass? And I've made it sure it's not mediate, it's moderate, because there's only so much a peacekeeper can do. But I want to talk about today of what our goal is. Our goal is to have an exchange of information in polite and courteous ways, with no personal attacks, no personal comments that are derogatory. This is an exchange of information on an educational basis. And I hope we can all walk away from here learning something. I'm going to assume that no one in this room is getting paid to be here. We're all citizens who are concerned about the Willits Valley, and we want to learn more about it. And I welcome you here. I welcome you to engage in good conversations. I think we're going to have some duplicate questions. So on your yellow cards, we are going to go through those. And if there's duplicates, we're going to try to combine them into one question. But get your best question out, and we'll pass the basket around. So we're going to start with David Parch. And David's going to give us a very good overview of the watershed and the wells, and we're going to continue on. And after Rosamond, Bob is going to give us a lot of information on wick drains, and that's probably one of the biggest reasons I'm here other than being asked to. I don't know what a wick drain really does or really is, so I'm excited about learning more. So thanks for being here. David, it's yours.
Okay, I'm David Parch, and I'd like to start off with saying thank you for being invited to talk here. I'm always happy to get that kind of opportunity, and I also want to thank all of the people who did all the hard work to organize this. It's so nice to, for a change, be able to show up and only have to talk and not do all the work behind the scenes, and I know how hard and frustrating that can be. So when I was asked to talk here, I didn't know exactly what they wanted me to talk about at first, and then somebody said that I was supposed to talk about wells, and I think the advertisement kind of led people to believe that. Well, I'm not going to talk about wells, at least not very much. What I do want to talk about is just setting the basic framework, the vocabulary and common understanding of watersheds in general, and more in particular about groundwater and the implications of that. So this is going to be, a 15-minute whirlwind, or it might be a little bit more than 15 minutes, but a whirlwind tour of watershed basics. So strap on your belts and get ready for the quick trip. And it's going to be very basic. None of this is rocket science. It's all pretty much common sense. And I'm going to start with probably the most astounding fact that you'll ever hear about watersheds, and that is the fact that water runs downhill. How many of you are aware of that fact? Okay, so you all have a very good basis for understanding everything that you need to know about watersheds, because that is actually the defining fact of a watershed. Watershed is like a basin. It's kind of like a bowl, but it has, you know, one end of the bowl is a little lower than the other so that the water can drain out of the bowl and eventually, most of the time, into an ocean. The fact that where the water runs downhill defines the watershed. And so if you imagine a ridge and the water flows in one direction on one side of the ridge and flows in the other side on the other side of the ridge, then that's going to be the defining boundary for the watershed. So what that also means is that basically what defines a watershed is contours. And before I get into this slide, I want to talk about just generally about that. A contour, how many of you are aware of contours? Okay, good. So you're all pretty much experts already. And I'm going to skip forward here. This is a contour map, and you all know that if you were to walk on a perfectly level line around a hill, you would get this very curvy line. Looking at it from the top, you would get this very curvy line, which is the contour. Now, here's the $64,000 question, or maybe today it's $64 million, I don't know, but the big question, and you can answer this, in which direction does the water flow? Well, with respect to the contour. Down, but what does that mean? If you look at these contour lines, they're very complex, but at every point on that contour, the water will run perpendicular to the contour. So it won't stay on the level, it will run downhill, but that means it's always going to be perpendicular to the contour. So, most of you can look at these maps and make a little bit of sense out of them, and some maybe more than others. They're generally pretty complicated, so I have used my exceedingly enormous artistic skills to put together this simplified drawing of contours. And there are just a couple points that I want to make here. The dotted brown lines that you can see represent the ridges, and in between the ridges, it drops down into a valley, and that's, of course, where the water is going to end up flowing down the hill. Although on the area between the ridges and the river or the creek in the bottom of the valley, it's always going to run perpendicular to the contours. Another thing to note with this is that where the contour lines are closer together, it means the slope is steeper. And where they're farther apart, it starts to level out. So this is an even more simplified drawing. as you can tell. This is actually, if you looked at a cross-section going across this ridge line here, right? If you looked at a cross-section of that, it would look something like this. And this may sound really simplified, but this is the kind of the standard or common shape of all hillsides. They have a relatively flat ridge line, and then they have a steeper area, and then it flattens out in the bottom of the valley, of course. So when we're talking about watershed maintenance and management, the most important thing to consider is the speed or the acceleration or the velocity of the water. Where do you think in this picture the water is going to run fastest? Where? From the top, but where is it going to pick up speed? When it goes down that steep slope, right? In other words, it's going to start out fairly slow up here at the top, but it's going to accelerate as it goes down the steep hill, and it's going to slow down as it gets down in the flatlands. When we start talking about wetlands, we're going to see that that's what defines a wetland, is when it, basically speaking, more or less stops flowing at the bottom. So this is kind of a very general pattern. And if we go back and look at this again, and now if we take a cross-section running along the ridge here, it's going to look something like this. It's going to have that same kind of S-shaped or sine wave-shaped curve to it. So everywhere in the landscape that you look, you're going to see this kind of a pattern. Now, you're all probably familiar with this kind of a relief map, right? The thing that's interesting about this, the shape, is that if you turned this over and looked at the contours from the other side, it looks very similar. And that's because of this kind of mirror image effect of the landscape. And like I say, this is important for consideration with water management, because what we really want to do is we want to slow that water down. Why do we want to slow it down? Because if it runs off quickly, we don't have it to use, obviously, and it's not going to be very, it's going to leave our landscape dry and arid, and it's not going to function very well for living organisms. So we want to think about what factors can enhance retention, water retention in the environment. And on the other hand, what factors will detract from that, will degenerate the environment. One of these is the steepness of the slope that we've talked about. Another would be the type of surface that it's running on. So if you have bare soil and it's very compacted, it's going to run off a lot faster than if you have a healthy natural environment, and I'm going to be talking about that in just a second. So those are two factors related to the velocity of water. The other is that we want the water to infiltrate into the ground and run through the ground, which is what we call groundwater, because the water runs much, much slower through the ground than it does through the surface, obviously. It's impeded by the soil structure underneath the ground. Unfortunately, this makes it somewhat mysterious because we don't really know what's under the ground. So we don't really know where it is, how fast it's moving, in what direction it's moving, and where it collects, and that sort of thing. So it's much more difficult to deal with than surface water. But another way to slow the water down is to force it to infiltrate into the ground. Now, I want to talk a little bit about systems, natural systems, that do this for us. And that's those natural systems, or tree systems, also known as forests, are the thing primarily that's responsible for retaining water in an environment. So if you look at this wonderful drawing here, you recognize the tree structure. The important thing here is to see that this creates its own environment. You see these green droppings here, the leaves falling on the ground. And, of course, there's a lot of other organic matter and organic debris that gets deposited on a forest floor. And it builds up this wonderful big sponge on the floor of the forest. And that sponge acts just like a sponge. It will absorb water, and it will hold that water for the use of the plants and other organisms in that environment. So it acts as a sponge, so it minimizes the amount of water that's going to run off into the rivers and creeks. So that's one aspect of this. The other aspect is that this kind of horizontal arrow here represents fog coming in from coastal areas, especially closer to the coast. You get a lot of fog, and these trees tend to trap that fog and cause it to drip. In some redwood forests along the coast, this can mean up to the equivalent of about 17 inches of rain every year, just from fog drip. So that's another way that trees and forest systems trap water and retain it in the environment. There's another way that the tree does something like this, and that is that it will act as a pump. It will actually pull the water up out of the ground and push it up into the foliage or the canopy, and from there it will transpire back out into the air. And of course, in a system, in every environment, not just forest, but in every environment, there's a certain amount of evaporation involved. I want to throw out at you a couple of figures. In a healthy, temperate climate, in this kind of forest environment, it breaks down like this. All of the water that does not run off, but all of the water that is trapped in the system, which is an enormous amount of water, of that, evaporation accounts for 25.6%. Transpiration, which is the water that's pumped up out of the ground from the roots up to the foliage and then out into the environment or into the air, accounts for 48.5%. So to almost half, right? And the amount of water that flows through and infiltrates into the groundwater is only 25.9%. Now, a lot of people think of transpiration and evaporation as bad news. I don't, because I think in terms of a holistic system that's intact and working well. And what that does is, and I'm going to have to go back to the first slide that I skipped over. What that does is, in terms of the water cycle, we don't rely only on the evaporation coming out of the ocean, which would be down here, right? We don't rely just on that evaporation to get our precipitation, but very far uphill in a working system, it creates a mini cycle up in this area that forces the water to go back up into the air and come down in summer rains, a very, very beneficial factor for a watershed. So in a system that is functioning well in a natural way, this transpiration and evaporation are actually good things because it's actually a form of water retention. It's the thing that keeps the water from running downhill quickly and going out to the ocean. So we all know about this water cycle. It's pretty clear. But this picture shows in a very simplified form what we really want, what we want to avoid. We want to avoid that runoff as much as possible, the surface water runoff, and we want to encourage infiltration. Trees do that in a very natural way. There are other mechanical ways of doing that, like using swales and other means of doing something very similar. But the natural systems do it, of course, a lot better. So I'm going to skip back to where I was. So I'm going to go to here. This particular slide shows how groundwater and surface water also interact. So in other words, there's not a strict division between groundwater and surface water, but they actually interact. This represents a cross-section of a creek bed. Whoops. And this is the creek down here, the surface of the water in the creek in the summer when it's a lower flow. This dotted line up here would represent the flow at peak. So in the summer, of course, the groundwater table is going to drop out. And with that, the seepage from the groundwater into the creek is also going to stop or drop down. So the level of the water in the creeks is to a large extent dependent on the groundwater, especially in the summer months, for its continued flow. And of course, if that level were to drop down even further below the bottom of the creek, your creeks are going to dry up. And I think most of us are very familiar with that phenomenon here in this area. I have been told, I haven't been here long enough to know this myself, but I have been told that as little as 30 or 40 years ago, the creeks ran all summer long. I know maybe some of the rest of you can verify that, but I'm sure that if you went back even farther, you know, 100 to 200 years ago, you would find that that was even more so the case. And that's because we have done a lot to break up this natural system that keeps that groundwater flowing.
I'm going to skip this. This is just maybe I shouldn't, because we're here primarily because of bypass issues, and this is an important part of the continuing talk. What this is a simplified drawing of a pond, and when you build a pond, of course, you dig out some area to hold the water in, and you build a dam over here. And when you build that dam, it's very important that you install what's called a key in the dam. This key is essentially a deep trench that runs along the dam and goes down into the ground, and you have to take some heavy clay and put it down in there, and you have to compact it as much as you possibly can. So what this does is it creates kind of an underground brick wall. And this is very important for the retention of the water in your pond, because otherwise that water is going to seep out into the ground and go downhill and get lost. So this acts as a way to slow that process down drastically to keep the water in your pond. So very briefly about wells, and I know this is the topic that I was supposed to talk about. Wells will, of course, take water out of the ground. That's what their function is. The groundwater, however, if you remember, moves very slowly as opposed to surface water. So when the water is taken out of the ground, it doesn't take it out in a level fashion across the entire landscape, but it actually takes it out in this cone shape. So the impact of water being pumped out of a well is limited to a certain extent, you know. So the farther away you get from the well, obviously, the less impact it has, because the water is not going to just fall back in there quickly. It takes several months for the water to move through the ground enough to make up for that. The other thing that this picture is supposed to illustrate is that when you take the water out of the ground, you remove a certain volume of the ground itself, and you will find that this ground level itself will subside. And there's a picture in the back of the room somewhere, I believe, that shows that in the San Joaquin Valley, over a very short period of time, the valley actually dropped by as much as 30 feet. So the ground level over a period of time dropped, and that was obviously because of fairly extreme overpumping. So this can happen. Now, if you're lucky, it's not too terribly bad because when the groundwater is recharged, the ground can bounce back if it stays, you know, aerated enough and fluffy enough. But if you do it to an extreme and in certain conditions, it will collapse the soil, and the soil will no longer be able to absorb that groundwater back into it, so it will not raise back up again. This is, of course, related to the topic of wick drains, because the function of wick drains, as I understand it at least, is to make that compaction permanent. So before I go on, and I'm running out of time, so I'm going to try to skip through this as quickly as possible. When you talk about larger volumes of water, you have to talk in terms of other units than gallons, because a gallon is a very small amount of water. And we usually talk about acre feet. Now, to understand this, it's best to imagine a cubic foot, like a box that is exactly a cubic foot, and you pour water in there. And the amount of water that will fit in a cubic foot is 7.48 gallons. An acre foot, if you can imagine a flat surface that is an acre in area, a flat surface, and it was filled up 1 foot deep, that is an acre foot of water. So translated by this formula here, you end up with the equivalent. The 1 acre foot is equal to 325,851 gallons. So that's what an acre foot is. Now, this is going to relate to some of the statistics we'll see in just a few seconds. So this is our Outlet Creek Basin, and this map here is the map that I worked on to make it look a little bit more well-defined than it usually is in a standard contour map, because the creeks are not, drawn thick and bold enough to see them very well. But anyway, here's Willits, and this is the little lake valley here. And this is basically speaking the Outlet Creek Basin. It's cut off a little bit at the top, but basically it's good enough. So this drawing here is exactly the same map, essentially. You can't see this up on the screen very well, but this lower area here is what's referred to as the southern sub-basin of the Outlet Creek Basin. And it's essentially identical with all of the water that runs into the Little Lake Valley. So it's basically our most local sub-basin or watershed. So this southern sub-basin has 66 square miles, which comes out to 42,240 acres. And if you figure, and I take this as just a ballpark figure, but if you figure that the average rainfall in our area overall is something like 4 foot, right? So you have to multiply that 42,000 something acres by 4 feet, and you get a total rainfall in an average year of 169,000 acre feet. So that's our, in an average year, our potential water source. Now, we know that a lot of that is going to go into evaporation, transpiration. A lot of it's going to go into the ground, and some of it's going to get trapped in reservoirs. It's not all there, but that's the potential. This slide shows the Little Lake Valley fill, which is important to know or to understand how much water can be stored in the Little Lake Valley. The top level, which is up here, and by the way, this picture is exaggerated. It's multiplied by 25 in the vertical direction, so it's not as deep as it looks anywhere near this and on the image here, but This is for illustrative purposes only. So this top layer is what we call the alluvial fill, which was deposited in approximately the last 10,000 years. Down below that, there's something called the continental basin fill, which is much older and a little less capable of storing water than the alluvial fill. If you look at the map of Little Lake Valley, it breaks down to the alluvial fill is more at the northern end, which is where the water leaves the valley. It's more on this northern end here. And at the southern end, it's more continental fill, continental basin fill. So it's less capable of storing water. Now, I'm almost at the end of my talk, and I get to the final bottom line here, and this is the thing you've probably all been waiting for drastically. And on the edge of your seat, you want to know what is the total potential groundwater storage in the Little Lake Valley. And now, of course, we don't know, but the best estimates that people have made, and this is from a USGS survey that was written back in the 1980s, it's anywhere from, on the low end, 23,000 acre feet up to 48,000 feet of water. So somewhere in the middle is probably more the truth, you know, 35,000 acre feet. Remember that an acre foot is 325,000 something gallons of water. So this is an enormous amount of water, actually, and to give you a way of comparing it, the two reservoirs that we use in here in Willits in the city, Morris and Centennial, hold together something like 1,250 acre foot, not 12,000, 1,250. So we have to compare that to something like 35,000 acre foot. So that's the bottom line, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bob. Or do we need an announcement?
Thank you, David. No. Okay. Thank you. Well, I went to South Fork High School, and I never heard of anything like this. This is very interesting. Thank you very much. So as we're getting set up, Rosamond Crowder is going to continue talking about the wetlands overview, which is obviously a very important part of it. So, Rosamond, thank you very much.
Well, while Bob's getting the slide up, most of what I learned from the Outlet Creek Basin Assessment. That's a pretty big study done by the Department of Fish and Game, which is now called the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And it was published in 2008. Well, actually, it was never published. It came out in 2008 in draft form, and it's not really available to the public, although the draft is circulating around, has been circulating around. I don't know why they haven't published it, but there are copies about, and I've read one of them. And let's see. I've also studied the bypass for a number of years. I've studied the mitigation plans a lot, so some of this information I got from the mitigation plans. So is one? No, it's slide number one. There's a number.
Oh.
There's numbers on all of them.
Well, no, don't you want to go backwards? Oh, you mean number one?
Yeah, number one.
Oh, I'll be darned. There it is.
No.
Yeah. That's it. Thank you.
It's a picture. It's number one.
Oh. Okay. Number one. I don't have that.
Oh, no.
Well, I have number one.
That's not, it's not in that number. Wait a second. It all
okay.
changed.
So what do you want? What's it called?
It's called wetland image. You only got five pictures.
Okay, so the reason for that is it's probably...
They're really huge.
Yeah, it's probably...
It's Little Lake Valley. That.
It's probably a different kind of image. What's it called?
One, the wetlands. One. See one? Okay, yeah. Okay, this is a picture of the Little Lake Valley wetlands. That's looking north, and you can see there's all different kinds of vegetation there. There's trees, there's where you can actually see the water, and then you can also see lines of trees, and so there's fields there that are agricultural fields, and then as it gets more to the north, it's more varied. So that's more what it looked like a long time ago, the all varied. And so we can go to the next one. It's called wetland functions now.
Okay, so that's on another type of program, right?
Yeah.
So that's on Microsoft. What's the name of it?
It's called wetland functions. It's a...
right here, I got it.
Yes. Great. Thanks. Okay, so here's a little basic primer on wetland functions. What wetlands do is aquifer recharge. That's the water getting down into the groundwater. You can kind of think of it in a couple ways. You can think of it as keeping the groundwater there as it's coming down from the hills, or that it's seeping in and recharging the aquifer. That's because it's flat. The water isn't going downhill to the ocean. Another function is filtration. There are lots of specialized plants, and the soil itself is like a sponge, and it filters the water. It filters it kind of like in your heater. There's a little air filter, and it has all those little fibers, and so the plants are like fibers, and the soil also filters it, and there are lots of microbes because it's full of life, and the microbes eat toxics. And you can kind of think of them as kind of the liver and kidney of the ecosystem. So that's part of why they're so important. We all need livers. And also the wetlands, the waters are moving really slowly, and when waters move slowly, they leave their sediment. The sediment drops out of the water because fast floodwaters, they eat up the banks of creeks. And so when they slow down, it deposits the sediment. And that's a good thing because then the minerals from the sediment spread over the wetland. And there's other functions. The wetlands absorb and hold carbon, and this is really good in terms of ameliorating the greenhouse effect. So they also are home to an amazing variety of plants and creatures. And so the biodiversity, that's called biodiversity. And that's also really, really important because all the plants and animals depend on each other. And so the more variety there are, the more happy they all are. And because people like to build on flat land, they are filled in. The wetlands are filled in all over the world. And so in a way, they're kind of like an endangered species. And people began to recognize this sometime in the 70s. And so the state and federal laws were made to ensure that there are no net loss of wetlands. That's how they speak about it. And the what that means is that if you are to fill a wetland in, you have to create another one. And that doesn't always work. People haven't been very successful in creating wetlands. And so in the sort of about 2008, there became another way that people could mitigate for filling in wetlands, and that is there's it's called the watershed approach or credits, and I'll explain a little bit more about that later. So now I'm going to go to historic land management.
Number three?
Three, yes. And it's a...
Right there.
Yes. Can you see the whole thing? Can we make it so you can see the whole thing?
Sure.
Great.
It's getting close.
Okay, I think that's all of it. Are you sure?
Yep.
Is there another? Okay, so I'm calling this historic, and what I mean is this is for thousands of years. And for thousands of years, people were managing the land in a way. They were using fire to promote oak woodlands, and that's because that was the staple food. So I'm talking not just about wetlands, I'm talking about the whole watershed, because as David explained, the whole watershed is a system, and what's going on in the wetlands is partly from what's going on outside the wetlands. So fires, and then it's not just people that manage the land. Animals also manage the land. So here are elk, for instance, and they would eat all the little trees and make sure that there are meadows. And so beaver, for instance, also manage land, and they manage for wetlands. They love wetlands. There's not a lot of places that beaver can really live in Mendocino County because it's, as you know, very steep. Little Lake Valley would be one place, and up by Van Arsdale Dam, that's another place. And so the results of this management was that in the old, a long time ago, there was a lot of biomass, and this is what David was talking about in terms of lots of forests and holding the water in the system, and the creeks were connected to the floodplains. I'll explain that a little more later, and there was a lot of habitat diversity, and in Little Lake Valley, there was a big lake, and it was a lot bigger than it is now. And the fish would come up and they could connect all the streams where they actually spawn because the lake was big and it stayed there till about May. Okay, is that better? Okay. There, thank you. Okay, I'll try that. Okay, there. Okay, and creeks in the wetland were undefined. This was pretty much a huge, what's been called an inland delta. And so the creeks in the northern part where the wetlands are, they moved all around. And so I can go to the next one. Okay. It's called new land management. Okay, and as Dave was explaining, there's the trees hold the water, and the new land management, there was a whole lot of logging, and this started, some 150 years ago. This is like 1860, and there was a whole lot of logging. And then later, there was channelizing of the streams, and this is in the northern part of the valley, the wetland area. And that was to make those fields suitable for, well, for a while there were a lot of potatoes grown, and now there's a lot of grazing. There was some gravel mining, and I don't know the extent of that. Maybe someone here knows a little bit how much gravel was taken out, but that also lowers the water table. And later, there's just a lot of development, houses, roads, so there's a lot of impervious surfaces, and what that does is it increases runoff, and there were also dams. And the thing about dams is it changes the sediment. I was once told that there's a river of water going down, but there's also a river of sediment, and when a dam is there, the sediment comes into the dam and it can't go any further. And so below the dam, the river, the creeks are hungry. And that means they're digging out because the water's going faster because there's no sediment, and so they dig out. So the kinds of things that happen is that there's less biomass, so with all those trees gone, it's not holding the water so much. There's not so much transpiration, and the soils are not holding so much. And the whole landscape is drier. And that's also true when the channelization happens, and that was the point. That's the point of the channelization, is to make the lands drier. And so they are, and consequently the lake in Little Lake Valley is way smaller than it used to be. And there's a problem with that. and that is that the fish can't get to their spawning grounds when the lake is smaller and isn't there for so long. So I'll explain a little more about that later. So with the dryer, with the channelization, the gravel mining, the water table has dropped. And when the water table drops, the creeks in size, and what that means is they get deeper, and I'll show that later too. And some of this incising is a natural consequence of all the things that are going on, and some of it is intentional, that people actually dig out the creeks. And there's also more runoff, and there's also a whole lot more sediment. And I think... No, the next one is connected and incised creeks.
Yeah,
it's a drawing.
I got it.
Okay. So,
oh, that's pretty.
Great, here we go. This is my attempt at artwork. And the creek on the top is a creek that is connected to its floodplain. And you can see, just like David had drawn, the groundwater, and it daylights where the creek is there, and that tree has its toes in the groundwater. And on the right, oh, it's not coming out very, oh, it wasn't dark enough. But on the right is the flood stage, and it's hard to see, but the water is filling above there. The water can pop out of its little creek bed, and it fills the whole floodplain, and it drops its sediment. It's a lot gentler, and it sits there. It fills in the aquifer. And it takes a long time to leave. So here is an incised creek, and that one is just in this deep, deep ditch. And you'll, when you see around Little Lake Valley, for instance, Hale Creek is hugely, hugely incised. That's one of the deepest ones. And pretty much all the creeks are incised. And you can see the water table is so much lower, and that's also stressing the, some of the trees in the summertime. Like this one can't get its toes in the groundwater. And on the right is during flood stage. The groundwater is higher because it's winter, and the floodwaters are rougher. And when they're rougher, they're chewing up the stream banks. And there's more erosion, there's more sediment, and woody debris piles up. This can make huge, huge piles of wood in the creeks. And that can make it hard for fish to get through. So.
About the next one?
Yeah. Which is sinuous and straight channels.
So that's a Word document.
It's a drawing again. It's not
that. So what's the?
It's a drawing like the last one. That one, the one on the top. The one on the top. Okay, yeah. So here are two different kinds of channels. The one on the left is sinuous, it's called. It's like a snake. And you can see it's very complex. There's a lot of different kinds of habitat in there. There's a gravel bar, and there's woody debris. And that's woody debris that's actually wedged into the creek bed. And that's a place for a little fish to hide. And there's, you know, the wood is rotting, and so there's a lot of bugs, and the fish eat the bugs. So a lot going on there. There's a riffle. When a creek gets skinny, there's a riffle. A riffle is where the water's kind of laughing across the rocks, and that's putting oxygen into the water. The fish need the oxygen. And there are trees all around, and that makes shade, and the leaves from the tree fall. That's also food for the bugs that the fish eat. So this is kind of ideal. And on the right, we have a channel. And the channel has trees along one side, and that shades it, but only for half of the day. And it has, when you clean the channel out, you push the dirt onto the side without the trees, and that has to be maintained. So The Department of Fish and Game has approved the one on the right. And there's a reason for that. Because in a Little Lake Valley, because there's less water, the only way for the fish to get through is to actually maintain the channels, because the water table is lower than it used to be. So that kind of gets us to the bypass. I know you were dying for that. Oh, okay, so I'm the that one, yeah. So this, I'm going to thank John Ford for letting, I forgot to ask him if I could use this slide, but I can. Well, maybe you'll want to talk about it more later. I hope you will. This is work. The Fords have been working with the Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife, for a long time. And the one on the top is a stake that was put in 1997. And that is a 36 inches tall stake. And on the bottom, can you move it? Thanks. Here is that stake 3 years later, and it is 18 inches tall. So that is 6 inches of sediment a year. So, of course, these creeks did jump out of their channels and deposited sediment on the wetlands. And it happens all the time. And in the Outlet Creek Basin assessment, from upland, this is sediment that comes down from all the roads, all the country roads, all the creeks upstream. The estimate is 24,832 tons of sediment per year. It's a lot. And I mean, I didn't factor that down into dump truck loads, but there it is, 6 inches. So, okay. Okay, so now what's going to happen if the bypass happens? There's this mitigation plan that's part of it, and I got the 5 minute sign. Yikes! Okay, yeah, do that one. That one. Okay. Here's a picture of the wetlands that I got out of the mitigation plan, and it's a little hard to see, but. You can see the red at the bottom, that's the bypass footprint, and all the yellow is the mitigation lands, and then those blue arrows are which way the water flows. So the lake at the top, it's sort of speckly. That's typically what the lake is these days. Although occasionally you can see the black line, that's as big as it was in March of 2011. That's how big the lake was. It didn't stay there very long. Mostly what stays there is the sort of speckly blue at the top. You see the speckly blue? That there. That's kind of the small version of the lake. And so, so it's really important that these channels help the fish get to the spawning grounds. And actually, the mitigation plan says that that will stop, that the channels won't be maintained. And maybe we can talk about that later. It's a concern about how the fish are going to get through, because we know the sediment is going to come down and fill those channels. So I also want to point out something that's really been concerning me, and that is at the northern interchange, you'll see a blue arrow that goes straight north. That is the drainage of that piece of land. And all of that red is actually going to be kind of a mountain. It's actually 30 feet where it crosses the railroad. And that whole northern interchange is like a mountain. Some of it's 20 feet high. It's all compacted. That's where the wick drains are. And so it looks like a problem to me. So now the floodway. the one you keep going to, the one you like so much. Yeah. Okay, yeah, this is the one. Okay, this is the map from the environmental impact report in 02, and it was used again in 06. And this is what, this is a map of the floodway, and it's not very dark. There is a 100-year flood marked on it, and it's so light, you can't really see it. But I have another copy in the back on the information table. And so I think that they did their studies in 06 using this map. So now I'm going to show you what the map looks like now, and that this next map.
Next one?
Next map, yeah. The FEMA flood one, the one that says Big FEMA. Yeah.
On top.
On top.
That one. That one. Okay, now this one is this is the same map, only this direction. So go up. Yeah. Okay, so you have to go back. There. Okay, so this FEMA map, that dark part that I've colored in blue, that is like the old map, and then these different levels of gray are different kinds of flood. And you can see that these creeks, the orange is the railroad, and there are culverts under the railroad, and some of those culverts are actual fish barriers. The fish can't get through them, like up on Hale Creek. But here, this is within the city limits, and you can see that they're kind of pinch points. And so what happens when there's a big flood is that the water has to go somewhere. And so, for instance, right in the north there, it's going due north. Remember that blue arrow in the other picture? That's the direction this water is going. And it hits the northern interchange. And what they've done for drainage is they have these culverts. And these culverts are incredibly long. They have to go all the way across underneath that fill. And I'm really concerned about those culverts. I know Cloverdale. Cloverdale had problems with culverts that Caltrans built. And you'll see the county is relinquishing from where that northern intersection is down to where the city starts. And then the Caltrans is relinquishing to the county that piece of land, and to the city, the next piece of land, the next piece of Highway 101, excuse me. So that will belong to the county and to the city. And what happened in Cloverdale is a piece of road was relinquished to Cloverdale, and there was a culvert built by Caltrans that didn't work. It flooded something. I don't know who it was that flooded, and that person sued both Caltrans and Cloverdale, and Caltrans and Cloverdale had to duke it out to see who was going to pay this person, and Cloverdale ended up paying $800,000, not to mention fighting with Caltrans how much that in legal costs that cost. So I'm just worried that that kind of thing could happen here, especially when, you know, these long culverts. Okay, another thing I'm really concerned about is the herbicides one. Another thing I'm concerned about is what the Army Corps has asked for mitigation. They've asked for, because they're trying to mitigate for 89 acres of impacted wetland, and there's a map back here on the information table that you can look at the bypass footprint, and it shows with all different colors all the kind of impacts. So there's a lot of wetlands. This is the largest wetland fill in Northern California for 50 years. This is the statistic I keep being given, and when I tried to research that, they weren't even giving wetland fill permits 50 years ago, so it's, you know, it's large. So the problem with what the Army Corps has asked for is to compensate for all of those wetlands with 480 acres. And that's because they could only create 50 acres, and the rest of it they had to enhance. And in order to do that on 450 acres, this whole credit system, which, by the way, is brand new, this is the first time this credit system has been used. We're the guinea pig. They are planting native plants, very intensive. There's five different types of plantings. And they'll scrape off topsoil, plant these little plants, and hope they survive. And when they do that, there'll be a lot of bare ground, and it's a perfect, especially in a wetland, a perfect place for invasives to come. And they've been saying, oh, you're supposed to clear up the invasives by weeding. And so hand weeding 450 acres is pretty far-fetched. And so these are the options, all these pesticides. And you'll notice 2,4-D, Roundup. Of course, if you're using, these are wetland plants that are not Roundup ready. And so to use these kind of herbicides without killing your, you know, your brand new little wetland plants, I don't know how it's going to work. It looks pretty shaky to me. But I'm not an expert. I'm just a layperson. But this is what it looks like. So then my last slide.
Uh-oh. What's your number?
It's
12.
13. And it's a photograph.
All right. I'll find it. You can look at the audience.
Okay, so it's a photograph. It's called Grazed and Ungrazed.
Number 12.
Yes, okay. So here is what's out in the wetlands right now, and you'll see the field in the front is a grazed field, and right behind it is a field that is ungrazed. And immediately you can see there's a whole variety of plants out there on that other one. And what is planned for the rest of the acres, which is 1,400 acres, is something kind of in the middle of this, where there will still be grazing, but not as intensive. There's this rotational grazing. And the rotational grazing is mimicking a herd of elk going through a savanna. And not a savanna, a wetland. And so there'll be little paddocks, and the cows move from one to the other, and they stay there about a month. And so it mimics herds going through. And so the result is intended to be somewhere between what you see here in the foreground and what's in the background, which is more diversity. So, thank you.
Well done, Rosamond. Well done. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to hear everything there is to know about from Bob Whitney on wick drains, and then right after that, immediately after that, we're going to gather your question cards, and then we're going to take a quick 5-minute stretch. So this is good stuff. Bob, you're up.
All right. We have a microphone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. A couple of people sent away for industry information, so we thought we'd pass the wick drain. If you want to order, you can see me after the meeting. Just kidding, of course. There's examples of wick drains in there. It's kind of interesting. They look like a plastic flute. So if I hear some music out there, I'll know that you're wicking. So here we are. First of all, I'm not an engineer. I've never seen a wick drain in action. But this is what it looks like when it's flowing with water after it's been installed. And prior to placing a horizontal connection to drain it off the site. So now you've got the installed wick drain coming, bringing the water up from the groundwater up to the surface. So it is a well. Some people refer to these as wick wells, and that's reasonably accurate.
But these are used throughout the entire Western world for engineering to accelerate the drying up of the construction project. And in this case, it would be used underneath the fill dirt that would be planned from the end of the viaduct, on the north end of the viaduct, just past the city wastewater treatment plant. And I have some maps later, I'll show you that. And then it would be continued on for about a mile to just north of the northern interchange, just past Up Creek. So wick draining water from saturated soil. So that's how it's used. It's to accelerate the compaction of the project. And then the next slide is kind of a diagram. And by the way, all these slides are not from my collection. They're from the internet, and you can go and look up wick drains, and the industry has, it's a huge business. There's major construction companies that specialize in wick drain installation and production of the actual product. And you can see there's a large machine that has a kind of a punch. It's not really a drill. It more or less punches its way down into the ground using what's called a mandrel, and either vibration or just pressure, hydraulic pressure, to push its way into the saturated soil. Because remember, most of these wick drains would be installed in wet conditions, in wetlands or saturated soil conditions. And then you can see where there's a diagram at the bottom there where it shows the vertical holes that are that the wick drain is placed into, inserted. And then these are, it doesn't say what it's, but it looks like these are the horizontal drains. And then the downward, the radical perpendicular downward arrow there is kind of a amateur artist's rendition of flowing water into the stream. And we'll get to that later. That's obviously what David Parch and Rosamond Crowder were talking to you about, is where does the water go? You know, you bring it up out of the soil, the saturated soil, with these wick drains, essentially wells, to the surface, and then you drain it off horizontally to somewhere else, right? Okay, well, we'll see how that works. Okay, so here's wick drain facts. And now when I use the word facts really loosely, because I tried to find verification for the 55,000 holes. I think it's an estimate. I have not seen it in writing, but I hear that it does exist, and even I read it in the Willits News, so it must be true, right? But I do have some facts that I found in the Caltrans bid package on the mileage or number of meters. I'll show that to you in a little bit. So I think it's calculated based on a depth of about 80 feet, and the 80 feet will then translate into, if you divide that into the total length of wick drains being ordered for this project, then you'd come up with a 55,000. I think that's what somebody did. Anyway, approximately 55,000 holes would be punctured into the wetlands under the fill material at the northern end of the Phase 1 Willits Bypass. And remember, this is Phase 1. To insert plastic wick drains about 80 feet deep with spacing on a grid 3 to 5 feet apart. And it depends on the saturation. If it's more saturated and a lot more water down below in the groundwater to be brought up, then you might have 3-foot spacing. If it's not that much. You might be 4 foot or 5 foot spacing. Anyway, it's like a grid, if you can imagine a honeycomb of these punctured holes in the ground with this plastic inserted like a straw about 80 feet deep. And these are not taken out, by the way. The filter is put down on top of this. So they'll be there for a while, as long as the plastic survives. And so then we have Wictorine horizontal layout. And the reason they put the plastic on the horizontal is to drain it off to the side, away from the construction project. And, you know, some of these construction projects are quite large, as you can see from this diagram. That's the reason the reason I chose this is I think it looks pretty realistic for the conditions that you'd find out in the Little Lake Valley if at the northern end. Remember, this is on the northern end, north of where the viaduct would end. And this is pretty realistic of what it would look like during the construction process. Okay, so here's from the information from the Caltrans bid package. They call it a drainage wick. And the number they have in the bid package is 1,350,000 meters. And then I translated that to the feet. So it's about, you know, the English system, it's about 4,430,000 feet, and it's 839 miles of plastic wick drains that they're expecting. Now, this is their estimate in the bid package, and, you know, you wouldn't want to assume that they're going to put all of that in or just that. Could be more, could be less. It all depends on saturated soils and the conditions of the settlement during the construction process, and they're very clear about that in the bid package. They go on and on for a number of pages, by the way, on engineering terms and calculations, and it's a science. And it can only be determined on the ground, so to speak, or under the ground.
Mr. Whitney?
Whitney. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's in the bid package. That's what you should order. If you're going to bid on this project, you might want to get your wicks in line. But it's a lot. But you have to put it, the other thing is you have to do it very quickly, install these, because the whole idea is to have this settle within a couple of months. You can't let it just, you know, sit there for years and years. So you have to get the whole idea is to get the compaction of the fill settled, and particularly the groundwater wicked out, so that you can have a solid foundation for your freeway. So here's now this. I didn't Photoshop this. I swear I didn't. I was tempted, but then I found this and I thought, wow, this is perfect. You know, I don't know what country this is in, but the Army Corps couldn't have been on the site. They wouldn't have allowed this. And you can see where it's creating a quite a bit of water, and the clear skies indicate that at least it's not raining that day. So where is the water coming from? It's groundwater, right? It's coming up to the surface. These wick drains work. And you can see how mucky it is. And the guys over there in the corner here, whoop, sorry, I got excited. Hang on. There you go. These guys, they've got boots on and, you know, they're mucking around. This is messy work. Look at this guy. He's stuck. I think he's got a problem. I think John's going to have to get his tractor out there to pull him out.
But
so you can see that these are very effective systems. Engineers know what they're doing. That's for darn sure. Okay, Here's the information that I thought you'd appreciate from the draft environmental impact report dated May 2002, 5.5.6, the impact analysis. This is the only place I could find any reference to anything about WIC drains. One paragraph. The only activity that would penetrate into the groundwater table anticipated as a part of any build alternative would be the placement of support piles and footings for bridges and structures, the relocation of groundwater wells, the placement of WIC drains and any associated dewatering activities. These minor and isolated intrusions are not expected to impact the quality of groundwater. Now, that was all the analysis. Believe it or not, I looked and looked and looked for some appendix, some supplemental document, some reference, nothing. Now, I'm sure there must be. I just couldn't find it. And we're going to ask Caltrans if they can find it. If there was some environmental review or evaluation of the 55,000 WIC drains, we'd like to know. Okay, so here's, I know from a distance there it's kind of hard to see, and this first slide thank you very much. I guess I heard some footsteps behind me. And thanks, Lucas, or Luke. So you can see from, let's see, oh, there you go. Okay, right here in this area, there's a little bit of a sliver of a triangle, and you can barely see some vertical lines there, right? That's the WIC drain field on the northernmost portion of the proposed bypass. So that's just north of the interchange. And if you're familiar with that lonely road to the north of Willits that you can see on the Caltrans website, here's a trailer park, I believe, mobile home village, and here's some mobile homes. And it's just before you get to the old scales there. So here's the beginning of the WIC drains on the very northern edge. And then I'll try to, here's the proposed interchange and the roundabout. Here's the interchange crossing up creek. Right here, I believe. There's the roundabout. And so here's the WIC drained field right here. See the vertical outline? And it would go under essentially the fill of the proposed freeway. So that's the next section south. And the reason I show you these details is that there actually is a specific plan. You know, these are, of course, are engineering plans that are proposed. It really depends on when you're out there and you're drilling in the ground. They don't know what's down there 100%, and they want to go out and do some test pile driving and other activities in the very near future this summer. So that's when the engineers will really know and the geologists will really know what's down there. So this is the next section just south of the proposed northern interchange, and it crosses, you can see the railroad tracks, and it's crossing here with a, I wonder why there's going to be a bridge there. What do you think this would be used for? Oh, a bicycle trail. That's what it's going to be. Yeah. So that's the WIC drains moving south. And, it even says WIC drains there. See that? I just noticed that on this big screen. That's very helpful. Okay, and this is the southern, very southern segment of the wick drains, way over here. There's just a little sliver just when the viaduct ends. You can see the viaduct is ending, yeah, right about here. And here's the wastewater treatment facility for the city of Wick. Is it Willits or Wick? Willits. Willits or Willits? Or Wickets. And Brook Trails, of course, and they're partners on this, as you know. Okay, so here's my editorial comment. These wick drains will drain water from the soil, but without drainage settlement ponds, which I couldn't find, the turbid water can be expected to drain into the adjacent outlet creek. Apparently, there was no environmental evaluation conducted on the adverse impacts of wick drain sediment draining into this adjacent anadromous fish stream, and no mitigation to avoid this significant adverse impact. So that will be brought to Caltrans' attention that they may have made that error. We don't know. And here's the final kind of industry. This is on industry brochure photographs. I know they're really proud of this work. You can see Little Lake Valley in the background there. And then over here is the old Ford farm. And I see that marker out there, yeah. It's about 6 inches showing up now. So I think there's a beaver pond in the foreground. So that's the end of my comments. Thank you.
Bob, thank you. Bob, thank you very much. So your yellow cards, please get those in. We're going to pass a basket around, and we're going to take a five-minute break. And if you say you want to take one longer than five, you're more than welcome to. We're going to start here in 300 seconds.